The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful website building platform. As a Guardian podcast listener, it goes without saying that you're a clever clogs. The good news is that building your own professional website with Squarespace is easy. Whether the site you need is for a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog, getting started takes seconds. Go to squarespace.com today and show support for this podcast and get 10% off. Use the offer code Guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Nicola Davis. Coming up on the show, how does the human brain heal itself? What are the implications of the science of neuroplasticity? And are the claims being made about the reversibility of symptoms of conditions such as Parkinson's and MS well-founded? We speak to the psychiatrist and author, Norman Doidge. Plus, Ian Sample joins us from the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Norman Doidge is a Canadian psychiatrist on the faculty of both the University of Toronto and of Columbia University in New York. He started out as a poet and a student of philosophy before moving into psychiatry. He authored guidelines for the practice of intensive psychotherapy before working to integrate new discoveries in neuroscience with existing psychiatric, psychological, and psychoanalytical knowledge. In 2007, he published the best-selling book, The Brain That Changes Itself, and has just written the follow-up, The Brain's Way of Healing. I'm delighted to say that Norman Doidge joins me in the studio, together with Dr. Dan Riesel, a medical doctor and research fellow in epigenetics at University College London, who's working on how to optimise behavioural change in patients to increase well-being. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Norman, before we talk about your new book, can you explain the concept of neuroplasticity?
Sure. Neuro is for neuron, the nerve cells in the brain that fire electrical signals, and plasticity means adaptable, changeable, modifiable. And as I understand it, neuroplasticity is the property of the brain that allows it to change its structure and function in response to activity and mental experience.
And is this happening all the time? Is this happening from the minute we're born?
Yes. As far as we know, yes.
And when did you start to become aware of the potential for neuroplasticity in healing or the brain to kind of repair itself?
Well, that would have been around the year 2000. I was aware of neuroplasticity as something that had been well established in neuroscience labs. And in the year 2000, the Nobel Prize for Medicine or Physiology went to Eric Kandel, who had shown that when an animal learns, there are changes in connections between the cells. But I have an office on the edge of the University of Toronto, and I ended up seeing a lot of people, professors and students, who were having crashes and burns in their studies. I started to understand many of them had learning disorders. And at the time, the predominant teaching for learning disorders is that it's a wiring issue or you're missing certain processors and it's a problem for life and you have to learn to work around them. But I began to think about the Kandel experiments, and Kandel was at Columbia where I trained. I discovered that there were some people who claimed to do mental exercises to help them. Barbara Arrowsmith was one. And so I immersed myself in her work and went to her school. And so that was around the year 2000. And I saw the children or even young adults who had not changed for their entire lives with their learning disorders were able to change with intensive work. Then I threw myself into the library and started traveling through the world to see other instances of this for stroke and other kinds of problems.
You give lots of examples in the book of different conditions that have been helped with different mental processing techniques or sort of different ways of training the brain. Were there any stories that sort of jumped out as being particularly influential?
Each one in its time jumped out. And some really important lessons were learned, like Edward Taub, for instance, would work with stroke patients, and he had made certain discoveries working with animals that were relevant for stroke patients. When a person has a stroke, the brain becomes very preoccupied for a period of 6 weeks to several months to deal with the bleed or the clot. And what we find is that there's a global loss of function, even if the stroke's in a very local area. This crisis was discovered over 100 years ago, and it's called diachysis. Taub discovered that if people try to move during this period of crisis, they can't process movement. They develop something he called learned non-use. Physiotherapy still, unfortunately, was based on the idea that you wait till the crisis passes, you know, 6 weeks or so. And most of the physiotherapy is really designed to prime the pump, to see what's left after the damage is done. And what most people did when they had this stroke is they had learned non-use. They tried to use their affected limb. They couldn't, so they would use their good limb. What Taub would do is put the good limb in a cast or a sling so they couldn't use it, and then incrementally train up the affected limb very, very intensively. And so he called it mass practice and increased the amount of physiotherapy people do. And he was able to show that people who had strokes decades before could still use this technique to make significant improvements and go from being completely dependent on others to independent. But, you know, in the current book, a lot of the treatments actually involve the use of a combination of mental practice and some kind of energy-based intervention to stimulate the brain. What I found as I internalized the lesson from Taub's research was that learned non-use occurs in many, many different kinds of brain problems, diseases, or injuries. The circuitry often goes dormant. Mm-hmm. It's not firing as much. In my book, I discuss some studies that were done, for instance, of a woman who had a brain injury and couldn't move her limbs very well. And they tracked the firing of spikes from neurons, the signals from neurons, and they found that there were much fewer. So in these new techniques, we use the senses as doorways into the brain to stimulate more brain activity. You know, we see things, we smell things, we hear things, but there are no images in our brain. There are no magnificent odors in our brain. There are no sounds in our brain. There are these patterns of electrical firing. And each of our senses connects us to patterns of energy in the world, and then they are what are called transducers. They convert those patterns into the patterns of electricity. So we can use the senses and the body to influence the neurons to change their firing patterns. And because the brain is plastic and pliable, these experiences can alter structure.
Obviously, in the book, you, as I say, you give lots of examples of different conditions that can be helped with some of the techniques that you outline. A lot of them are very anecdotal. How much of this has been subjected to clinical trial or to any kind of more rigorous trial?
It varies by chapter to chapter. You know, science develops in stages. It starts with hunches and wonder, and then you usually have some people who are very creative trying new things. They try to perfect their techniques, and at a certain point, their techniques get studied and then restudied and so on and so forth. So, you know, I have a story about a man with Parkinson's who did a lot of movement. He had his own unique way of moving, and then he got walking. And, you know, there were many people who doubted that, even though he was well diagnosed by several neurologists and his doctor, and I met them, there were people who would see him moving from across the room and say, well, now that he's moving, clearly he never had Parkinson's. And this happens a lot when people have recoveries that aren't supposed to happen because we believe the brain was fixed and wasn't plastic. But in that chapter, for instance, there's a wonderful review by the Mayo Clinic of all of the studies, animal and human, in movement. There are things coming out every few months about movement in Parkinson's. So there's a lot of, in fact, my technique is to try to use people's left and right hemispheres when I try to communicate with them. And that a combination of scientific evidence where it's available and individual case histories. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of evidence, And some of it's really almost stunningly interesting. Like they have examples from the animal literature where we have models of Parkinson's. They're not identical to Parkinson's, but we can give animals Parkinson's-like symptoms. Learned non-use is very relevant to them. If you give animals a certain chemical that depletes the dopamine in their brains, which is what happens in adults in Parkinson's, and you get them moving right away, in fact, they will do very, very well. It's surprising the power of exercise to generate new growth factors in the brain, etc. And the implications for human beings are, it's profound because it implies that exercise should be something that's not an afterthought for patients with Parkinson's. The studies of low-intensity lasers, there's several thousand studies of low-intensity lasers, clinical trials. So they're there for those things. There's about 450 studies of the Taub technique.
And I wanted to talk a bit there, before we come to Dan, about some of the techniques that you're talking about in the book. Especially there was an example of a lady who had chronic pain, and she was able to alleviate this pain within, was it 6 weeks, of changing the way she was thinking. Mm-hmm. Is there a danger, or is there a possibility here that essentially you're sort of implying that people's ability to alleviate their symptoms comes down to sort of mental willpower? I mean, that seems like a slightly strong thing to be saying.
Well, but that's not what I'm saying. That's a sort of a blunt version of what I'm saying. Here's what I'm saying. I'm saying that now that we understand that the brain is neuroplastic, there might be some conditions, and indeed there are some conditions, that are amenable to using not only traditional approaches, but the person's mind to help them. And after all, chronic pain is a kind of mental experience. It's not so far-fetched to think that. And there are, as well, there are thousands of years of traditions of, you know, meditation and other things to deal with suffering. So there's nothing far-fetched. But if the concern is about dangers, there are many dangers that face us as human beings. One danger is that we overstate the role of the mind in helping certain illnesses. The other danger is that we understate it and leave people suffering. This woman that you're describing, Jan Sandon, was a nurse, and she'd lifted a very heavy patient, and she'd had severe, severe damage to her back, and she spent years on medication, and she had no life. She was, you know, groggy on the medication. She was still in intense pain. It just wasn't working, and she'd had all of the conventional, she'd had injections into her nerves and so on, and many of the complementary treatments, nothing helped her. To discover that there are some new treatment approaches available for some patients doesn't require that we generalize and say illness isn't simply a matter, you know, if you're struggling, it's simply a matter of lack of willpower. Besides, it's not just about willpower, it's about understanding how the brain works so that you can turn certain switches.
Dan, let me bring you in. How much do we know about neuroplasticity and how those changes take place in the brain? I mean, is there more to it than nerves that fire together, wire together?
Thank you, Nicola. Yeah, well, I think the first thing to say, when Norman was speaking just now about the power of individual stories of individual patients, I think I'd actually like to say, I think the individual patient perspective really does add a huge amount to this study, because whilst it's critical to have large-scale studies, randomized controlled trials, we can't lose sight of the individual patient either. And whilst you were talking, I was remembering a patient that I saw with Parkinson's disease, and he developed this method where he could walk when he sang. By singing, he was able to distract himself, essentially, from his disability. And it worked for him. And sharing those kinds of anecdotes, I think, is really valuable. Another patient that I saw not too long ago, who'd just undergone what we thought at that time was a stroke. I just remember him lying in the bed. He was an elderly gentleman. And we said, we need to bring you up to the ward to give you a clot buster so that we can try to save some of the tissue, which is rapidly being suffocated without oxygen in the brain. And he looked at me and he said, but I'm just an Irish bricklayer. Are you sure they will treat me? And it just dawned on me, I think, in that moment, how all the things that we bring to our illness, to our situation, has an impact on our health. And it's so vital, I think, to put the patient back in the center. So that's why I think, although, as they say, the plural of anecdote is not data, the large-scale trials are important in order to be able to generalize. It's so important not to lose sight of the individual patient and how they find their place. And yes, to answer your question, we do know a lot more now than we ever did about how the brain is able to adapt and change. A lot of the science that underlies your clinical encounters, I think, is classical neuroplasticity. So the strengthening of connections between nerve cells as they fire. You mentioned their electrical properties, but of course, as you well know and is well known, they're electrical only within each neuron. Between each neuron, they're chemical, which is why neuropharmacological treatments work. So they're electrical and they're chemical. And I think there's a lot of really exciting work being done today in the last decade or so, not only on how the connections between nerve cells can grow and develop, but also how new nerve cells, new neurons can be born in the human brain. And that's a process called neurogenesis, which is the subject of intense research at the moment. There's a lot to suggest that certain kinds of experiences, perhaps even psychotherapy, certainly some forms of pharmacological medications can create new neurons in the brain. It's a very exciting field.
In the book, it kind of comes across a bit that neuroplasticity, so the sort of underlying principles of neuroplasticity, give rise to a sort of cure-all for such a huge range of conditions. Is that something we should be wary of?
I think the word cure is a very ambitious word. Often what we see is something much less sensational, something much less dramatic, that ultimately takes place over a long period of time. I think we do have to be careful not to overstate our claims. In general, I think we damage the integrity of our research if we appear to give people false hope. The other thing I think is worth mentioning is that often when people have an illness or are experiencing disability, there's an element to that where they need to learn to live with limitations, to learn to live with their new condition. But it's very important as well, I think, to be mindful of whether those limitations are real or whether they're imposed by society. So if you're a wheelchair user, the fact that you can't access a counter in a bank because the counter is too high is actually not your limitation. That's the limitation of society that's not set up to cater for each individual's needs. It's important to make society more accessible for people with a whole range of abilities.
I'm very careful with the word cure. It's used infrequently in the book. A lot of these conditions have shown radical improvements. You know, we're coming off a period of time where if you have a physician who was educated in the 50s, 60s, 70s, even 80s, the doctrine of the unchanging brain, this idea that the brain is hardwired and, you know, past early childhood, there was nothing that could be done to change it, ruled. And clinicians' expectations were based very much on that. One patient after another in this book was told that they wouldn't get better. What I tried to do by showing instances of people getting better who had been told they couldn't is to show that there's something wrong with the existing paradigm. It's too blunt. It's too all-inclusive. I'd never make the claim that every person, you know, with one of these illnesses would get better. I'm very, very careful about that. I'm not arguing that this kind of neurological nihilism that we've had should be replaced by some kind of neurological utopianism, and I'm very explicit about that in the introduction to the book. As I see it, false hope and false despair are evil twin brothers, each vying to do harm. We're trying to correct for a period where we had an incorrectly pessimistic understanding of the brain's ability to adapt. And so I see these not simply as mere anecdotes, but anomalies. I see these as cases which challenge the existing paradigm to moderate itself in its pessimism, not to become overly enthusiastic.
As you say, there sort of seems to be a resistance in some medical spheres to kind of embracing the potential for the brain to rewire itself, mm-hmm. to find ways around some of these problems. Is there something that you think, is there one sort of study or a set of studies you think would help to convince practitioners?
Because the studies have all been done. I mean, they've been done thousands of times. The idea that the brain is neuroplastic is not, I think, remotely controversial in mainstream neuroscience labs. The issue is translating it into clinical practice. There's all sorts of things that get in the way of rapid. First of all, it's not surprising to learn that we do not live in a medical utopia where new treatments are immediately distributed to all people overnight. Mm-hmm. Doctors have to choose, you know, what they do based on what's insured. These are time-intensive interventions. You know, to bring a new drug to market costs billions of dollars, and they have a business plan for that. This involves clinicians being able to spend more time with their patients or training new kinds of clinicians. Neuroplasticity, although mainstream within neuroscience, requires new kinds of approaches. And I mean, of course there's going to be controversy to some degree when people are, you know, asked to retrain or learn new techniques. If you read the history of science, it's just never the case that a new idea comes along without there being the proponents taking a certain amount of heat. Mm-hmm. If you're not taking any heat ever, you're probably proclaiming that the existing model of the moment is all that we need.
And where would you like to see this sort of go in the next 10, 20 years? As you say, it might take some time before some of these techniques that you outline are sort of embraced more widely.
That's exactly where I'd like to see it go. I'd like to see the existing knowledge we have be made more available to more patients. Mm-hmm. I mean, I speak to Edward Taub about this because he's a scientist and, you know, there are whatever it is, 450 studies, and he's working on 451. And I don't think 451 is going to make the difference in getting it out there. It's a matter of getting better at teaching people about these things. And the physiotherapists have become very interested in neuroplasticity. I find the young neurologists are very interested in it because they were educated, you know, they learned these experiments as part of their medical training. But I think that we have to shift to a model that sees something like these kinds of interventions as not simply an afterthought, particularly for some of the, you know, these disorders like pain. You know, one of the reasons that our treatments for chronic pain don't work nearly as well as we wish is because the brain is neuroplastic. And so we give people certain kinds of pain medications and the brain adapts to their presence and says, I can handle this. And the receptors inside the brain change and patients become tolerant as the brain adapts to the medication. We have to increase the medication and unfortunately side effects increase. So this kind of rethinking, even at a chemical level, of what are the effects of our psychoactive medications on the neuroplastic brain have to be integrated too. And once we integrate that, we'll realize it's just much better if we can use both medication and the patient's own mental life. I can say in psychiatry that, you know, a third to a half of my patients are on medication at any given time, but almost all of them all the time get some psychotherapy. But in American psychiatry, with all the pressures on psychiatrists, that I would say that's increasingly rare. It's just increasingly medication consults, short-term medication consults. But that's not based on the interest of the patient, I don't believe.
Dan, where do you see this going in the next sort of 10, 20 years? Do you think it's going to become a bigger and bigger part of clinical practice?
I think so. I think to pick up on what Norman just said, there's a lot of evidence out there that what really is able to change a person's behavior, but also their mental state, is the combination of a physical therapy, a chemical therapy with psychotherapy. That's not nearly as powerful as one or the other on its own. I think at the moment in Britain, just to bring that in, there is an emphasis on the sort of quick fixes of cognitive behavioral therapy, so CBT, which do have their place. But it's, I think, important to recognize that in many cases that the change isn't quick and it's not immediately quantifiable. As an example, my wife is a social worker in Hackney, which is an area of London with many people of low socioeconomic status and struggling. And she sometimes says that her aim is not to turn that individual service user's life around, but rather to try to create some kind of change that will enable their kids or their grandchildren to have a different outcome, to go to university, to change their life. And it's so change is slow. How do we implement change? How do we enable change to be as widespread and as powerful as it can be? I think the kind of crosstalk that Norman's book, I think, excels at is one of the ways forward. We're not going to be able to make these changes unless people from different disciplines, clinicians and non-clinicians, scientists and non-specialists, get together to work through the ways in which the research can be used to ultimately benefit the general public. I think something like the Wellcome Trust's new initiative, Ethics and Society Program, is really terrific in the way that it doesn't only focus on the narrow science, but actually takes into account the social, economic, cultural factors that impact health and healthcare practice. So there's a lot more crosstalk that we should be doing, and that's one of the commendable aspects of this book.
Norman, some of the processes and techniques that you outline, they seem to sort of be something where once they're set in motion, the patient can kind of start to train their brain themselves.
Yes, very much so.
Do you hope that people who perhaps are suffering from some of the similar conditions that you outline in the book might go to their GP and say, well, you know, how about this? Is that something you hope that people might start to sort of
Yeah, I hope so, but in the world in which we live, for instance, the pain chapter, the doctor who pioneered this technique's written a book. People contact him. Doctors can consult with him. He has written a book that patients can use. Others of the techniques require a clinic set up with expertise. Some of the things are actually quite low tech, which is the beauty of it. I discuss in detail the role of walking. I mean, we've known a long time that exercise generates growth factors in the brain. People just have to understand how important it really is for the brain. You know, only in anatomy textbooks are the brain and the body separate. In reality, in their physiological functioning, they're seamlessly related. That's why these body-based interventions can be so helpful. So it's a combination of some things that are easily available to everyone and others where it would be great if some clinicians trained in these techniques. And then once they've trained in them, they get their patients doing these things, and then they just have to monitor them at that point, just to make sure they're doing them properly. The other thing is there are some techniques that, like the sound-based interventions, which have worked so well for some children with learning disorders, sensory processing disorders, and even helped some children with autism make very significant improvements. You may have noticed that a lot of children with autism are often covering their ears, and that's not a minor problem for them. And the sound-based interventions can radically lower their sound sensitivities. They're so sensitive to sound that they're always in a fight or flight reaction. That makes it very, very hard for them to relate to other people. There's a whole system in the brain called the social engagement system, which allows us to turn on the circuitry for facial expression, speaking, and listening, literally to turn it on. And it's not on when you're in the fight flight. So the autistic children are played certain special frequencies that train their brains out of that hypersensitivity. And then they start to get more related to people. Now, some of these techniques have been actually around for a while, but because the mainstream view was that autism was simply genetic, as opposed to in a genetic environmental interaction, which it really is in most cases, and that the brain wasn't plastic, it was very, very hard for people to credit that you could actually use sensory experience to change brain structure in something that was so fundamental. So there are people in England who've benefited from some of these treatments already.
I mean, does this tie in with a sort of more general paradigm shift in medicine about how the body and the brain and different aspects of our bodies interact? I mean, you sort of talk there about how people used to think of the body and brain as being sort of very sort of separate entities almost and very sort of hardwired. There's been sort of huge amount of work on things like the microbiome and other aspects of physiology as well. Is this part of a paradigm shift?
Yes, it is. It's part of this more general. Look, Western medicine excels in being analytic. The ancient Greek roots of that means to tear something apart. We're very, very good at that. And there's a lot that can be learned by taking a problem and dividing it up. But Humpty Dumpty has to be put back together again. The dividing up is reflected in the fact that we have medical specialties. You know, this person deals with the heart and this the kidney and this the brain, etc. But as the parents of autistic children have discovered, that autism is not just a brain disease, it's a whole body disease that affects the brain. And their children, they were often going to very different specialists. This microbiome stuff is just part of that. I mean, the discovery that things in the gut are affecting the brain, there's even some research that Parkinson's might have some beginnings in the gut or other places outside the brain. And Parkinson's patients often get diffuse gastrointestinal symptoms very early in their prodrome, in the beginning of the disease. So, the shorter answer is yes. I think we're starting to put Humpty Dumpty together again.
Norman George's The Brain's Way of Healing is published by Allen Lane, and Dan Riesel's Rewiring Our Morality is available through TED. Ian Sample has been at the AAAS, which finished earlier this week. Ian, tell us a bit about what's been going on there.
So this is the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And it's really the time when British science journalists come out to the US to sit in a windowless room and eat processed meat sandwiches and very large ones at that. And it's a general science conference. It's not the sort of place where people come to bring masses of new research, but you do get people coming and giving sort of syntheses of their work or giving some preliminary stuff, maybe just giving some opinions on things, and we feast on that for a week before coming home. There was a number of stories that came up. I mean, one of the interesting ones I enjoyed was a bit of a quirk that came out of a chat with some Stanford researchers who are working on autonomous vehicles, and they have a car that can go around a racetrack pretty much as fast as an expert driver. And it uses GPS and all sorts of things. It's horrific to see it in action. It really goes for it. And it's strange seeing, you know, there being no driver in it. But one of the curious things that came out of that chat was that something they're really sort of banging their heads about is what to do about when an autonomous car should legitimately break the rules. Now, this sort of comes to that whole point in driving where there can be situations where strictly you're breaking the rules. But how do you code that? How do you actually put that into regulations? For example, over here, you're not supposed to cross a double line, a double white line dividing two lanes on a road. But if you're in the lane and there's been an accident in front of you, then it's probably best if you go round it at some stage, whereas an autonomous vehicle at the moment will just sit there until the whole thing's been cleared up and towed away and produce a massive traffic jam. So, you know, equally, there might be times when it actually is better to speed if it means you're going to get out of the way of a tram or something like that rather than cause a greater problem. So what they're saying is they need to have quite an awkward clarification to the road rules, which would also obviously apply to people, which is really trying to say in writing, when are you allowed to do things that are strictly breaking the rules and when you're not? Because at the moment, AI cars aren't intelligent enough to actually make that call for themselves. And I suppose a lot of the time humans aren't either.
So is this a question of whether or not they're going to have to, in the intermediate time, have some sort of manual override? Is that one of the options that they're batting around whilst they're ironing out these problems?
That's pretty much where you are at the moment, the big red button option. So, you know, if you are in a situation where you think, actually, this car isn't smart enough to get me out of this situation, and if it doesn't get me out of this situation, things will be a whole lot worse. Then, yeah, you hope the driver's paying attention. They can hit the big red button to take over manual control and do what, a sort of a reasonable thinking human would do. How do you actually program that in when there is no general agreement and no sort of laws of the road that you can really rely on? Because all of this obviously and inevitably has to be backed up by regulations and it has to pass through all sorts of committees. So actually nailing down when it's okay to be bad, if you like, is going to take them some time. And so they're scratching their heads on that one.
Sounds like a work in progress there. There was also a story that came out, which has got quite a bit of attention, regarding Anne Boleyn. Can you tell us a little bit about that? It's regarding some facial recognition software, I believe.
Yeah, so this was preliminary stuff, right? But it's an interesting idea. So there are some researchers at University of California, Riverside, who were into facial recognition. That was their speciality. And they were contacted by some art historians to say, look, why don't we try and apply some of this face recognition software to Renaissance art, essentially, and to see if you can identify some of the characters, or at least you're not going to get proof positive, but you can at least give some information that will sort of go into the debate, if you like. So it'll be sort of further evidence to go into the sort of scholarly debate over who various characters in the background often are in these paintings. And not always in the background, though, because they did some fairly prominent paintings. One of the most sort of interesting ones for us that they tried to do was to try and find more evidence for decent portraits of Anne Boleyn. The only problem with this is that the only contested sort of contemporary image of Anne Boleyn is this beaten up and bent disc as a medal called the Most Happy Medal, which is in the British Museum. It's not a lot to go on.
Well, I have to admit, it does look rather more like a kind of cartoon character than any sort of decent representation, but that was their starting point. Is that right?
And this is the problem. That's their starting point. And this is the problem, which they declare in the talk. I mean, if you only have a small number of images that the system can learn on, then obviously that introduces some pretty interesting error bars into any conclusions you come out the other side. But they cracked on and sort of went ahead anyway, just kind of for the fun of it. And they came up with one painting which they thought pretty much was Anne Boleyn. And to be fair, I think an awful lot of scholars think it is as well. Although there have been some people who've said, no, we think it might be Jane Seymour, the wife of Henry VIII that followed on from Anne Boleyn. And it also didn't find matches, unsurprisingly, given the source material, actually, with some other paintings, which to me, I've got to say, they look pretty much like other depictions of Anne Boleyn that I've seen.
How do they tackle the problem of sort of style? Because obviously different eras have very different style of portrait painting, which can make a lot of people look very similar. You know, you look at some paintings from the period and all the women do kind of look the same. I mean, is there a part of that could be part of the error as well?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, this has got errors, sources of error are everywhere with this one, because if you look at normal facial recognition, you have to think, okay, the things that stump computers are the angle of the face that it's looking at, the illumination, aging. So if you have, just reference images from when someone was much younger. When you look to art, you have the distinctive style of that particular artist. So you have to look across, this will obviously change across artists. And they might do things which are just don't stand out as characteristic of the person than the reference material you have. But one of the nice things that they do is they take, as well as looking at all the facial measurements, so, the distance between your eyes, the distance, the width of your nose, with all those sort of anatomical measurements, they do this kind of quite nice thing where you take an image and you kind of knock it down to lower resolution, to the point where, to honestly look at a picture, you wouldn't notice these, but when you take it down to very low resolution, the particular features start standing out. So you will notice if, like, one eyebrow's straighter and the other one's a bit crooked and things like that. And you notice these strange things that don't particularly leap out at you when you look at an image, and certainly wouldn't just from making measurements. And you try and apply that, but it does some fairly smart stuff, but it's all reliant upon having good source material. And this was the tricky thing with the Anne Boleyn thing, is all they have was this bent metal, which isn't a fantastic place to start, but it's kind of all they had. So it was more of a fun thing to try. I mean, they tried it with a whole bunch of other paintings as well. And those, I think, they have better reference material for. But I think it's one of the ones where it's going to be a while before people take what they find as being serious evidence. At the moment, I think it's just a sort of, well, let's look at it and consider it, but nothing really much more than that.
So we're not really much closer to knowing whether the Nid Hall portrait is actually Anne Boleyn or not. Is that the kind of conclusion?
I think it is. Do you?
They're facing the same way, I suppose.
Anne Boleyn was well known for always facing in the same direction, and so maybe that's the clincher that
she's
we're
not
after.
An Ambi Turner. Is that what you're trying to tell me?
Yeah.
And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Norman Deutsch and Dan Riesel. From me, Nicola Davis, and all the science team, thanks for listening.